WFSU-FM now presents a delayed broadcast of the Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting of January 13, 2017. This program, featuring international security expert Jonathan Altman, was recorded at the Florida State University Alumni Center in Tallahassee. And now to introduce the program, here's Economic Club of Florida President Marjorie Turnbull.
On Valentine's Day, February 14th, Dr. Kent Fox, the president of the University of Florida, will be speaking. March 1st, Tim Geithner, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, will be our speaker, and that will be held at the Civic Center. So feel free to invite guests, and we will return then to the Alumni Center for the rest of the year. Gary Chartrand, who's CEO of Acosta, will be speaking, and this will be a fascinating program about shelf placement in our stores. Rear Admiral Mary Jackson, Commander of the Navy Region Southeast, will be speaking to us on April 25th. We are trying to pin down a date when John Teal, the Director of Wealth Management for Merrill Lynch, will come and speak on elder care fraud, which is an issue that is really facing the investment community and all of us, as a matter of fact. June 1st, we have Stuart Graff, who's CEO of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation. This is the 100th anniversary of Frank Lloyd Wright's birth, and he will be talking to us about Frank Lloyd Wright's influence on architecture and architecture's influence on our economy. We're going to give you off July, so happy vacation. And August 10th, we will have Paul Anderson, president and CEO of the Tampa Bay Authority. So look forward to seeing all of you at that time. I want to recognize at this time our sustaining members. As you all know, these are members who make a special effort in their support of the club. And if you sustaining members would please stand so that we can recognize you. I'd also like to recognize some students that are here with us. As you know, last year we started a program where we have five member student memberships for each of the colleges of business at our universities, and we are very fortunate to have these students participating with us. I hope you will interact with them and share your experience with them as you sit with them at the table. The FSU students are in classes the first week, but we are proud to have the FAMU students, and I would ask them to stand so we could recognize you. And also, our speaker will be introduced later, but I would like to introduce his wife, Anna Altman, and her mother, Jan Williams. We have a family connection here with our speaker. And thank you so much for being here with us. And finally, by way of intros, I just have to mention that our Vice President Ben Watkins was recognized recently with the Jim Liebenthal Infrastructure Champion Award. It's a highly prestigious national award. And Ben, congratulations. Where are you, Ben? Now, I would like to introduce the head table. And if you would, please hold your applause until the entire table is introduced. On my far left, your right, Amanda Stringer. Dr. Amanda Stringer is the CEO of the Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra, a position she has held for 6 years. And under her leadership, the TSO has expanded its reach from 500 attendees at concerts at Ruby Diamond to over 14,000 through programs in our schools and family concerts at Cascade Park. Our speaker, Jonathan Altman, will be introduced in a moment, and I want to say we haven't banished Ash from the head table. He requested that he be able to sit with his wife and daughter, but he will be introducing Mr. Altman in a moment. On my far right, your left, Christine Lamont, who worked for the state of Florida in information technology and information services for 31 years. She now serves as a guardian ad litem, is a board member of Child Advocates, and volunteers with Second Harvest of the Big Bend. And Christine is a new member, and we are so fortunate to have you. And next to Christine is Jay Revel, who is currently Vice President of the Greater Tallahassee Chamber of Commerce, where his focus is on growing existing industry, talent retention, and continuing efforts to define the Chamber's economic development role. He was formerly the Dynamic Executive Director of the Downtown Improvement Authority, and he also serves as President of the Capital City Country Club. And finally, Lo Bilby. Lo is a principal shareholder with Greenberg Traurig, a global full-service law firm. He is a business trial lawyer in all courts. I suppose that means right up to the top, right, Lo? As well as handles regulatory matters, franchise disputes, and employment issues. He is going to be serving as our membership chairman for the Economic Club this year. So be sure to share with him any names that you would like to bring forward as for new membership. You will be hearing a lot from him in the future. And now I'm going to ask past Chair Ash Williams if he will come forward and introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Marjorie, and welcome all. We're fortunate to continue our tradition of excellent speakers from whom we can learn and with whom we can grow. I'm particularly pleased today to welcome Mr. John Altman. I've had some experience with John, given he's married to one of my daughters, and I would applaud her judgment in the whole matter, as well as his. Think about what we've just been through, a presidential campaign, and now we're watching the installation of a new administration in the most powerful nation in the world. What are the implications of that for security, for safety, et cetera? Now think about what a campaign is. A campaign is a deep, wide river of talk and opinion, much of which may or may not have grounding in fact. It may or may not have relation to action later on. If you think about what the defense community does and the policy community does, their job is to understand where the facts are, draw appropriate inferences for security and the U.S. national interest and how that relates to that security picture, and then formulate and support actions through military and other channels to accomplish desired outcomes. What does all this have to do with John Altman? What it has to do with John Altman is that you have a professional military establishment, you have a political establishment, you have civilian officers, military officers. That's how the checks and balances work. Come back to the facts and the information. Somebody somewhere has to maintain the actual body of information and manage the drawing of inferences. That's where the interface between the private security policy community and the professional governance of the military and the political decision structure interface. So John's firm, Securities Planning and Analysis, at which he is a senior analyst and leads a team that advises senior customers in the Department of Defense on matters of military strategy, policy, and communications internally and externally. Think Congress and the White House internally, and for external things, the public, the media, think tanks, etc. That work routinely puts him in contact with military leadership and sometimes civilian appointed officials who are in the path of decision making. Preparing him for that important role, he has a master's in international security from the Corbell School at the University of Denver. I think I'm correct, John, in saying that there are only two schools in the country that have this very specialized advanced degree. One is Denver and the other is Georgetown. Is that right? So he went west and got into the skiing and all that stuff. And he also has a bachelor's in political science and graduated, I believe, with some form of distinction from Wake Forest. If no other distinction, meeting Anna. So at any rate, I would like to recognize John, thank him for being with us today, and his specific expertise in areas most of us don't traffic in daily, things like nuclear weapons, naval strategy, and the development of future warfare concepts, and he'll probably touch on that a little bit, I think is pretty darn interesting, and we look forward to hearing it. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today. Specific thanks to Dominic and Marjorie for extending me this invitation, Jenny for making sure all the pieces came together, and Ash for making the suggestion in the first place and then giving me that very gracious introduction. I'm honored to address you today. However, before I can get on with that, and this is one of those nuances of working in Washington, I'm obligated to tell you that I'm giving these remarks in my personal capacity, and to my knowledge, they do not reflect the views of my employer, Systems Planning and Analysis, the Department of Defense, or any other part of the United States government. Assuming all the lawyers are happy now, let me lay out what I'm going to be discussing with you today. In thinking about what topics would be most impactful to a forum like this, I of course reviewed the Economic Club's recent speakers. Not sure I should have done that because it's a rather intimidating list, and apparently the people that are following me are equally intimidating, as I learned today. However, I noticed that despite the prestigious resumes of many other speakers, they are heavily biased towards the financial world. Of course, something one should expect at the Economic Club. I, however, am not. And so accordingly, I thought the best use of your time and mine would be to discuss some broad perspectives on the world, U.S. national security, and how these two items fit together, leveraging my experiences working in the national security sector in Washington, D.C., a subject all the more relevant given the upcoming inauguration of a new president. Now, titling a talk like this is always going to be difficult. But in the end, I decided that calling this What's Been Going On Around the World and Why You Should Care is probably as good and direct a title as any. In the interest of time, I'm not attempting to cover the entire world country by country. We'll focus instead on regions, principally those of key importance to the United States, and what's been happening in these over about the last decade, as well as what the future might look like. Once we cover each major region, we'll then explore briefly what the trends we see mean for U.S. military and national security policy as the administration changes. That said, this timeline requires me to avoid great depth on any one subject, and so if I omit or gloss over any area of intense interest, please do bring that up during the Q&A session that follows. I will do my utmost to limit my remarks to no more than 30 minutes in order to allow for as many follow-on questions as possible and allow this gracious audience mercy as a reward for having paid attention to that point. Before we go any further, there are three overarching points to be made. These are what an academic might call framework. You can think of them as a scaffolding that will hold up my later arguments. Since we are in the Economic Club, the first one concerns the cost of the military. Despite what you may have heard from ill-informed commentators, and I want to harp on this one a bit, defense spending is not the cause now, nor has it been since at least 1965, which is the furthest back I can find data for, of U.S. national debt or the U.S. national deficit. The evidence supporting this claim is as clear as day. Since I'm in front of a group of people that understand budgets, finance, and the economy, let me spell it out in detail for you. In real terms, meaning adjusted for inflation, since 1965, defense spending has increased by about 10%. Over that same period, U.S. GDP has increased by greater than 300%, with federal outlays, meaning what the government actually spends, following GDP in terms of trend. Now, this is a smart room, so I'm sure everybody realizes that this means that while since 1965, the U.S. is in real terms three times as rich, and the government spends three times as much in total, it only spends 10% more on defense. Ergo, defense spending is not causing the debt. If you want to address that, things like entitlements, which have grown at far greater rates than defense spending, are where you ought to look. But my purpose today is not to suggest political programs, so much as make the case that defense cuts as a way to reduce the debt and or deficit are fundamentally missing the issue, and moreover punishing a sector of government that is not causing the problem. The next point I want to argue relates to the world writ large, and that is that influence on the world stage is a zero-sum game. Now, I assume not everyone has a background in game theory where the term zero-sum comes from, so I'll explain it succinctly. A zero-sum game is one in which there must be both a winner as well as a loser. For one side to gain, the other, or others if there are many players, must lose. This idea perfectly represents relative national influence on our home planet. As an example, look at the situation in Syria over the last few years. Whatever you think the Obama administration should have done, the choice made to not intervene gave an opening that Russia and Iran exploited, increasing their influence. The result of this was not that Russia and Iran increased the pot of influence available and just took the increase for themselves. No. The pot stayed the same size, but the U.S. share went down. Practically speaking, there are a host of effects that flow from this loss of influence, from supposedly U.S.-vetted rebel groups ignoring U.S. warnings not to fight alongside al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, which the New York Times reported was an issue in the struggle for Aleppo, to the Russians repeatedly ignoring ceasefires and breaking promises to not bomb purely anti-Assad rebel groups. While I've chosen to use Syria as the example here, rest assured that additional examples are numerous and widespread, from Yemen to the Philippines to Europe. So remember as we survey the world that influence is indeed a scarce and valuable resource. As a final framing point, and one that is likely most salient to this group, I firmly believe, and ample evidence supports this claim, that our nation's great prosperity depends in no small measure on the U.S.-led liberal world order. To be clear, I mean liberal here as in the classical sense of Adam Smith, not modern politics. Since I'll be referring to the liberal world order often in this talk, please remember that the modern definition of liberal actually bears no relationship to the classical one in this case. Getting back to the point at hand, I assert to you that the liberal world order, which so benefits us, is only possible because of America's enormous global influence in the form of not only finance, but also ideas. All of this in no small measure underwritten by U.S. military strength. Thus, I assert that the health, credibility, and capability of the U.S. military is now and will remain a key factor in ensuring continued American prosperity. In an election where both candidates have argued against international trade, one more than the other, of course, and elements of both parties have openly called for what would, in effect, be a return to isolationism, this point is all the more important to make. As a good analyst, I do not present assertions without evidence, and so here are a couple of pieces to back my claim. The first of these is that the internet, including nearly all financial transactions, depends for its function on the existence and reliability of a relatively small number of undersea fiber optic cables. If these cables were damaged or cut, global internet connectivity would immediately collapse, and the economic fallout would be disastrous. Think about having no e-commerce and what that would mean. Why doesn't this happen? Because the U.S.-led liberal world order has established norms against such behavior, and the U.S. military is there to punish any would-be transgressors. For the same reason, outside of very marginal regions of the world, piracy no longer exists. More generally speaking, the U.S. military underwrites the global free movement of goods and services, making modern trade possible. As an example, consider for a moment how cargo ships could be affordably insured for transit in a truly lawless ocean. This not only benefits a vast majority of the world, but also increases American influence at the expense of those who do not share our values. Refer to my last point about the zero-sum game. As you may be able to tell, all three of these framing points could be made into their own discussions. But in the interest of time, let's now use these framing points to examine recent world events. To me, it makes sense to start close to home, so let's talk about our neighbors first. Canada had an election in 2015 and replaced a prime minister who was seen as very close to the United States with one who was extricating Canada from direct involvement in fighting ISIS over American objections, though he remains committed to housing Syrian refugees. To our south, Mexico is economically vibrant, though suffering from a decades-long drug war that is devastating whole regions of the country. It is unclear how this war can plausibly be concluded, as profit incentives continually replenish the ranks of those who wish to fight the government to produce and export narcotics. Moving further south, Latin America is a rather mixed bag. While recent years have seen the democratic fall of an anti-American regime in Argentina and challenges to others in Venezuela, Bolivia, and elsewhere, these latter regimes have so far weathered these challenges. Brazil, which under President Lula da Silva and his successors has tracked steadily away from the United States, remains in turmoil following the impeachment of its elected president and continues to suffer from incredible domestic political corruption. At the same time, Colombia is as close to peace with its Marxist rebel separatists as it's ever been, and it remains to be seen what the future relationship between the United States and Cuba might look like, with some commentators arguing the opening is rewarding bad behavior, and others asserting that this opening will, at the very least, improve an acrimonious bilateral relationship, if not portend the fall of communism in Cuba altogether. Heading west across the Pacific brings us to East Asia, a region central to the United States economy. First, the good news. The United States continues to maintain strong alliance relationships with many nations in the region, but most importantly, Japan and South Korea, which, along with Australia, are the only three countries outside of NATO that have treaties formally committing U.S. nuclear weapons to their defense. However, it is unclear how these relationships will fare under President Trump, given some of his campaign statements regarding the value of our alliances. On the other end of the spectrum is China, where the strongest leader for at least two decades is spearheading an effort to challenge and replace the United States as the preeminent power in East Asia. This is not hyperbole. I'm simply stating a fact. China is an unabashedly revisionist power that benefited greatly from U.S. distractions in the Middle East after 9/11, using this time to make large leaps forward in military capabilities and coerce its much smaller neighbors, many of whom, like Thailand, Malaysia, Cambodia, and now increasingly the Philippines, which for the record had been a strong U.S. ally, are bowing to Chinese pressure. To be clear, when I say pressure, what I mean is that the Chinese are trying to rewrite the rules of the liberal international order I discussed earlier, the one that figures so prominently in American prosperity. So this should be of preeminent concern to all Americans. Whatever minor areas, like piracy, the United States and China may find temporary common ground on, the fact remains that the Chinese view of the world is at its core incompatible with the current international system. While this contest may not come to global war, and I hope it doesn't, it is still very much a contest that will determine the values that govern the world going forward. Authoritarian, mercantilist, and repressive on one hand, or individual freedom, capitalism, and openness on the other. Against this backdrop, the Obama administration has been unable to craft a remotely effective response. With the Washington Post's Josh Rogan reporting that even calling China, quote, an adversary was banned by the Obama White House, as if that would change reality. Accordingly, support is building in South Korea for that country to develop its own nuclear weapons. While Japan just revised its pacifist constitution to allow for stronger and quicker military responses. On top of all this, North Korea continues to be a nagging pain in the side of the international community, having conducted two nuclear tests in 2016 alone, despite a brutal sanctions regime, which is certainly an additional contributing factor in South Korea's flirtations with their own nukes. The Trump administration will thus have to figure out not only how to effectively confront China and shore up certain shaky U.S. alliances, but also leverage China if they wish to attempt to ratchet down tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Excuse me. Pushing further west, it is worth briefly mentioning here that tensions on the Indian subcontinent between India and Pakistan, both nuclear-armed states, are dangerously high. India has responded to recent unrest they believe caused by Pakistan's Kashmir with military strikes into Pakistani territory. This should be especially concerning given that both India and Pakistan have nuclear use doctrines which allow for very quick escalation from conventional attacks, such as those that have occurred in the very recent past, to full nuclear employment. South Asia's neighbor, the Middle East, likely to no one's surprise, remains a region of high interest to the United States. While a few dozen countries can be said to reside in the region, Really, any dynamic you'd like to understand can be boiled down to just two: Iran and Saudi Arabia. In Iran's case, buoyed by a release of cash resulting from its agreement to the much-touted nuclear deal, Iran is active in a host of conflicts around the region, supporting violent proxies in places like the Palestinian territories, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen. These proxies, moreover, seem to be growing increasingly bold, with Yemeni rebels under Iranian support firing cruise missiles at U.S. warships in October of last year. Faced with this challenge, Saudi Arabia and its close Sunni allies in the Gulf, remembering Iran has a Shia Muslim majority, unlike most of the Middle East, which is Sunni, have responded in kind, pursuing more muscular responses than in years past, most prominently in Yemen, where recent reports indicate that the Saudi-funded and led bombing campaign is causing extensive civilian casualties. Saudi Arabia is also reportedly interested in pursuing its own nuclear weapons. In fact, a retired Pakistani general recently revealed that Saudi diplomats had flown to Islamabad, Pakistan, to make exactly such a request of the Pakistani government, whose weapons program likely historically benefited from Saudi funds, a fairly disquieting type of quid pro quo. Beyond these interactions, Syria remains a festering mess and potentially holds the designation of the worst place to live in the world today. Massive civilian casualties and war crimes by all sides continue to pervade this conflict, which, as many of you know, is essential to the formation of ISIS. On that note, I do want to take a minute to make a few fundamental points about ISIS that are rarely made in public debate, to the detriment of the American public. First, ISIS is not an existential threat to the United States. They happen to be an annoyance and good at inciting fear, but you're far more likely to be killed in an automobile accident than any kind of terrorist attack. The numbers aren't even close. What ISIS is good at, though, and the media is their key enabler here, is making themselves seem like the most dangerous thing ever witnessed. Are they frightening? Sure, as much as a bunch of cowards that prey on women and children can be. However, they are an order of magnitude easier and less dangerous challenge than contending with China, Russia, or North Korea, and pose an incomparably reduced challenge to the survival of the United States. Should we confront them? Absolutely. To quote Donald Rumsfeld, who, regardless of what you think of him, was great at one-liners, quote, "They want to meet their God, we just arranged the meeting." Like I said, great at one-liners. It is really important to make sure we understand the threat of ISIS in context and don't get distracted swatting proverbial flies as an alligator approaches. That said, the campaign against ISIS seems to be going slowly but generally well, although it remains to be seen whether ISIS-held territory can be entirely reclaimed, and in that event, what Middle Eastern governments are willing to do to prevent an ISIS 2.0 from emerging in a few years. While the Middle East burns, Western Europe faces trials of a different nature. Structurally, the European model of integration is under threat from a right-wing backlash across the EU, angry at the open borders and ceding of national sovereignty required for European Union membership, and from a left-wing backlash against German-led austerity measures directed towards the continent's economic problem children. Confidence in many of the principles and institutions undergirding modern Europe is eroding, most shockingly exemplified by Brexit. Many Europeans fear their values are being threatened by refugees from the Middle East and North Africa swarming their borders and coasts. Democracy itself seems in some cases to be under siege, most directly in Hungary and Poland, where leaders are clamping down on liberties such as freedom of the press. Europe is assuredly at a crossroads, and only time will tell whether the European integration project continues or whether popular revulsion might irrevocably derail it. On top of all this, Eastern Europe faces the most serious threat to their security and sovereignty since the Cold War, in an increasingly strident and bellicose Russia, a topic I'll now move to. Concluding our survey of the world with its largest country, I want to offer a quote written by Alexis de Tocqueville, the Frenchman who famously chronicled early American democracy. Tocqueville wrote in the 1830s, and I quote, "There are now two great nations in the world, which, starting from different points, seem to be advancing towards the same goal, the Russians and the Anglo-Americans. The American fights against natural obstacles. The Russian is at grips with men. The former combats the wilderness and barbarism, the latter civilization with all its arms. America's conquests are made with the plowshare, brushes with the sword. To attain their aims, the former relies on personal interest and gives free scope to the unguided strength and common sense of individuals. The latter, in a sense, concentrates the whole power of society in one man. One has servitude as the principal means of action. One has freedom as the principal means of action, The other has servitude. My, how times don't actually change. Recovering from the breakup of the Soviet Union, Russia has, over the last 5 years especially, asserted an aggressive foreign policy aimed at recovering its lost influence, which includes such action as invading Ukraine, intervening in Syria to support a murderous dictator, and threatening the territories and sovereignty of many of its European neighbors. Despite an economy relying on oil, Russia under Putin has continued to prioritize military investments, fielding advanced weapon systems and using them to great effect. Concurrently, the Russian military is transitioning away from conscripts to professionals, and Russian officials have made dire threats, including that of nuclear strikes, against the United States and our allies, which is all the more worrying given the centrality of nuclear weapons to Russian national security thinking. Russia has also modernized its previous Cold War approach to information warfare, and for years has conducted campaigns to discredit media they don't like and bolster misinformation they produce themselves. Included in this bag of tricks is meddling in U.S. and European elections. Make no mistake, much like China, Russia is a revisionist power seeking to rewrite the rules of the international order to better suit its needs and reverse the trajectory of the last 20 years of American and general global prosperity. As with a schoolyard bully, weakness simply invites further aggression. Taking everything we've discussed together, then, what do we see as informed observers of the world? I offer three key takeaways. First, global trajectories are headed in the wrong direction if you support a liberal, prosperous world order. While the U.S. has and should continue to pursue terrorists that threaten us, Russia and China have emerged as serious and credible challengers in their regions to the United States, and lesser challenges from Iran and North Korea have grown significantly. While great power conflict is not inevitable, it is more likely than at any time for the last 30 years. Second, this first takeaway is not well understood by the American public, or even most political elites. You need only rehash the recent presidential election for proof of this. While our candidates traded insults, Xi Jinping, that's the premier leader of China, continued reforming the Chinese military to better operate in high-end combat, like that it would see against, say, the United States. And Vladimir Putin ordered massive, no-notice exercises designed to demonstrate Russian society's readiness for war, involving its military forces as well as its civilian population. We are facing a truly existential struggle to maintain the world we've built, the relative prosperity we've enjoyed, and the peace we've cherished for 70 years. If we are to resist these emboldened anti-American competitors, the public must understand the criticality of this struggle and be supportive of it, even when sacrifices in other areas are required. Third, the military must be properly resourced to deal with this new era. As uniformed leaders have testified on multiple occasions, all branches of the military are suffering from crises in what's called readiness, which, for the record, means that when called to fight, many more Americans will be wounded or die because they lack the sufficient numbers and modern, fully maintained equipment needed to dominate. Our military personnel are being worked to the breaking point as time at home decreases in order to maintain forces overseas to fight enemies like ISIS, while simultaneously deterring nations in multiple regions from attacking our vital interests. And in the age of long-range missiles and cyber warfare, this includes deterring attacks on our home soil, an idea that for decades was unthinkable. You may have heard other commentators point out the size of the U.S. military budget or numbers of specific U.S. platforms like aircraft carriers relative to adversaries in order to suggest we have room for reductions. Well, let me be clear. No adversary or ally of the United States deploys its forces globally in defense of its interests as we must. We are the perennial away team because so many of our sources of essential materials and markets for our goods are overseas. As we realized immediately prior to two world wars and after 9/11, to prevent them from eventually coming here, we must resist them over there. And to sustain one unit forward to fight or to deter aggression, you need at least about three others at home. That's the key piece of information to understand when trying to right-size our military. In this light, strict comparisons of our military's total size to those of adversaries becomes irrelevant. And it is abysmal that the military remains saddled by the 2011 Budget Control Act, even though defense spending is not the cause of our nation's financial stresses. Congress is most assuredly shirking its constitutional duty to resource the common defense. The good news, however, is that none of these problems are unsolvable. All that's required is leadership, courage, and communication with the public, as many great presidents and congressional leaders have done throughout history. The real question now is which of our contemporary leaders have the courage and conviction needed to reprise this role. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take your questions now.
At this time, we're going to invite questions from our membership, and we are asking that only club members ask the questions. And please wait until the microphone comes to you to state your question. Dominic, are you first up?
Yes, okay. Thank you, Madam President. Jonathan, thank you very much for a very insightful presentation.
You're welcome.
What do you think is the optimal military personnel level? Per service, or average, how much below are we? What percentage or number of active military would you say we are short?
So it's going to depend on the service. Really, the question that comes before that is what is the role of the military in national security policy? So are we supposed to simultaneously be able to fight and win two conflicts? Are we supposed to be able to simultaneously fight and win two while deterring another one? The way uniform leadership will size the military is based on that. So they'll say, I'll plan against a conflict with some country and another one and say, roughly, I think I need this kind of force structure. That's defense speak for numbers of people and stuff, number of people and stuff, really. And that'll go kind of to your specific construct. Now, under current planning, I think the Chief of Staff of the Army has said things like, we're below, 450,000 is too low, certainly below that is too low. That's the kind of thing that, there isn't, this is sort of the funny thing with most planning, there isn't a bright line really anywhere. It's all a measured sense of risk. So might you have peace with an army half the size now? You might, but you're taking a lot more risk. And same thing with the Navy, right? If you can't be in many places, you can't be forward, you're generally not going to be very effective at deterring conflict. So you'll encourage others. So there isn't an exact bright line. I would say right now the reductions that we've had in personnel over the past about since the end of really the main effort in Iraq should be reversed at the very minimum. We probably need to grow. I mean, the Navy just came out and said, we've got roughly 274 ships. Today we need 355. Probably a decent place to start.
Jonathan, again, welcome to Florida.
Thanks.
We're glad to have you here. And thank you so much for that 30-minute journey around the world. And as we get back home, we have to begin to look forward. And our president-elect has begun to assemble the people that will guide us in that direction. And I'd be interested in your thoughts about the confirmation process, particularly of the Secretary of Defense, the nominee, and the Secretary of State.
Sure. Yeah, so I don't know very much about Rex Tillerson. I know what I read, so we're probably about even on kind of that knowledge. We don't generally work with the Department of State a whole lot. On Jim Mattis, it's funny that you say that. So when he was nominated, it was a little bit of left field. I wasn't expecting him to be nominated. There's this rule from George Marshall when he was Secretary of Defense that you need a waiver if you were in uniform for the last 7 years. And I kind of made up my mind about it until I went to something called the Reagan National Defense Forum, which is this big gathering at the Reagan Library in December. And you had two guys on stage who generally don't agree with each other a lot, former Secretaries of Defense, Dick Cheney and Leon Panetta. And both of them were pretty comfortable with the idea of Jim Mattis being Secretary of Defense. That combined with the current Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff giving a ringing endorsement, and a number of other people have said, I trust enough opinions to think that, he'll probably do a good job. And frankly, he has a very good reputation within the department. He's kind of called the warrior monk. He's got this tremendous library. He's very well read. He's done a lot of, he did something when he was a brigadier general, like go and relieve a corporal so he could be with his family. You know, so he's got a reputation as being a really good guy and someone who's sensitive to the needs of the department. So I wish him all the best.
Jonathan, thank you for coming. It was a great presentation.
Thank you.
Can you give us some insight as to what the potential end game is for Russia and Putin in terms of, I know, you know, they have oil, they have armaments, as primary areas of their economic exports. Where is he headed? What's he thinking? How is he trying to position Russia with or without the United States cooperation? Where is he going?
Great question, because Putin's got a really bad problem, right? And this is something that's worth a little bit of a larger point. Oftentimes when you live, work, and are only familiar with what I would call liberal democracy, freedom of the press, all that kind of stuff, open elections, that kind of thing, it doesn't occur to you that much of the rest of the world doesn't live that way. And so people like Putin and Xi in China and others, they don't go to bed at night knowing that they're going to be leader of their country tomorrow. They're actually going to bed at night thinking, what can I do to make sure that in the middle of the night, one of my deputies doesn't come and kill me and take over power? I mean, I say that sort of tongue in cheek, but it's not untrue. And so that's the lens through which you have to think about what they do. There's a lot of debate over whether Putin has some grand plan or he's just playing the cards he's dealt fairly well against a fairly inept opponent. My sense is there probably wasn't a tremendous grand plan, but as Putin sees weakness, he's emboldened. It's the same kind of thing you've seen many times. Generally, authoritarian states, when they see someone back down, go, great, it's sort of like operating with a gangster. You know, what else can I get out of you? I don't know what his grand plan is as far as the economy, other than to wait for the price of oil to go back up, because they really don't have much of a functioning economy outside of resources. That said, Russians will tell you, and you can read about it, that they are tougher than us. And what they mean by that is, you haven't lived through a Russian winter. You haven't done this thing where I'm eating cabbage for 3 months, you know, and sitting and freezing half to death. They do believe, perhaps with evidence, I don't know, that they are tougher than, you know, they think Western society is material. We need all these things, cell phones, the internet, you guys are weak. Their view is we're hardy and strong. You know, look at this country we live in. It's a frigid wasteland with nothing but oil. And they've adopted that. So even as their economy has contracted, they've increased military investments. The Russians are somewhat targeted. They don't invest everything across the board. But they do continue investments in things like nuclear weapons and undersea forces, submarines they invest heavily in. And they'll probably continue to do that. They're bleeding their own sovereign wealth fund dry. But Putin's approval, even in sort of uncolored surveys, seems to be really, really high. And so the thing you worry about as an American, as a sort of Westerner, is that the only release valve you get when you're Putin and the economy is really, really in the toilet and your people are massing in the street is to find an adversary outside who's responsible for it. That's the way you get a very large war, may spiral out of control. And that's the way you get great instability, where you say, I know how I'm going to placate you people. We're going to get Estonia. And you know, you kind of get people say, okay, you know, we'll go get Estonia, right, distract them for a while. So that's the preeminent concern I would have with what I would call a more or less declining regional power like Russia is, where China's probably on the way up still.
I have a question. So thank you very much for your interesting commentary.
You're welcome.
President-elect Donald Trump has advanced two very sensitive issues. One is, and I'll ask them both in the negative, why should the United States demand even more that our European, especially our NATO allies,
sure,
spend at least 2% of their GNP on defense? And then second is the question about Jerusalem. The president-elect's indicated he wants to move the embassy there. And my question would be is, why would we really care what the Palestinians think when Israel is our only friend and probably our only permanent friend in the Middle East, and that it's not likely that trying to placate the Palestinians in any way is going to abrogate the 2,000 or 3,000 years worth of wars that they've been waging on each other?
So I'll take your questions in reverse, because my answer to the first one's going to be shorter than the second one. I would disagree that Israel is our only ally in the Middle East. I think we are very close with the Jordanians. We are very good friends with them. And you have to realize that a lot of the things that you do in that region, you think are, you're just placating the Israelis, you're actually annoying other nations in there. So I would say, for this perspective, what is the U.S. to gain from it? I mean, the Israelis kind of do what they want now. right? They build settlements. We tell them, don't do that. They're like, eh, thanks for your opinion. So, I mean, what are we getting out of it, right? So that's kind of what I would come down to. Your question is, well, what are we getting out of goodwill from the, you know, Palestinians by not doing it? I would ask you the reverse question. I don't think there's an easy answer to that. On the NATO side, that's been a bipartisan talking point for at least the last 20 years. It's been challenging to get NATO countries without a really menacing threat. It's been challenging. Now, there are several more countries that are reaching 2% of spending this year than last year, and there's probably more after that. There are some that are just economic basket cases. It's really hard to imagine the Spanish ever getting to 2% because they have something like 20% unemployment. The thing we should remember, though, is that the characterization that we get nothing from our alliances is false. I mean, one, most alliances, for instance, the Japanese, pay most of the cost of keeping our troops there. So the idea that this costs us something is not true. It costs us a very small amount of money, and it costs, you know, deployment away from your family, sure, but they're paying for a lot of the base infrastructure. That's part of the basing agreement. Same thing in Korea, South Korea, obviously. The second thing is that by being there, we gain influence, right? We're not ceding that territory to someone else. We're there. Our allies have confidence that we will be there. It's a little principle for why we've had forward bases. We don't want to fight over here. We want to fight over there. I mean, that's the benefit that we have that basically no other nation has. The Chinese know if they get into a big war, it's not in LA. It's off their coast, or it's in their cities, or whatever it is on their borders. We don't do that. And so if you want to continue to have a forward U.S. defense posture, you must have alliances. You must have forward forces to deter. And frankly, the economic argument I find somewhat uncompelling because, like I said, most of the agreements already have allies paying quite a bit. But they should spend more.
Can we get them?
On your topic of cutting off communications and us being blind.
Yep.
There was a book I read last year called The Ghost Ship. I don't know if you're
familiar. Yeah, it's Peter Singer's book.
Could you comment if that's the way a major conflict might actually start?
Not easily. So Peter's book is the only book I've ever seen that is fiction but footnoted. So that's kind of a weird sort of weird thing. There's a lot of things in there that are somewhat fanciful. But is it a potential, are there potential ideas in there? Sure. I mean, beyond that, I can't give you much more. You know, trying to predict the future of conflict is kind of like we always know everything except the next war. So I'm not sure what value I give you in saying. Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad approach, right? I mean, we're relying on the internet, cut off the internet. It's not an awful approach if you're sitting in an enemy capital.
Let's take two more questions if we would. Yeah.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. But to summarize it, I think you said it right at the beginning. The liberal world order has been very good for the United States.
Sure has.
But that's the sort of standard argument of the hegemon, that the hegemony is very good for the hegemon. But I have, my grandmama had a relative by marriage who was a retired Indian Army colonel who wrote pretty much the same thing in the 1890s from the point of view of the UK. The Chinese might not see things the same way, and they do think there are a lot more of them than there are of us. Is the liberal world order necessarily better for Africans, former Soviet Union republics, China, India?
Well, so let's talk about it in context, right? There's an economic part to it, and in general, the world has gotten a lot richer. So that's, and there's not much debate there, right? The Chinese have gotten richer, the Indians have gotten richer, all those things. The reason why China and Russia and a few other states, Iran, don't like the liberal world order is not necessarily an economic argument. I mean, it is a little bit, but it's because they'd like to control more. It's mostly about the ideas. So there's an implicit set of ideas that go with this that says, you know what? It's not really acceptable to shoot your own people. Chinese go, ah, it doesn't really work for me. It's not okay to treat women like slaves. The Iranians go, eh, we'll skip that one. hey, it's not really okay to go, you know, invade a neighboring country. The Russians go, oh, comrade, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree. And so those ideas are more threatening to them. The idea, what? So going back to a point I made earlier, if I'm pretending I'm Vladimir Putin and I'm riding a horse with no shirt on in Siberia and free diving for a clay pottery that I happened to find that was 5,000 years old or whatever it was, I'm sitting there and thinking, what are the things that end in my death? Prematurely, not old in bed. Well, democracy, right? Because if there's truly a revolution, I'm toast. I mean, they're going to drag me from my palace and they're going to shoot me. An inside challenger, yes, I got to insulate myself against a coup. And you see, Putin kind of kills everyone or removes everyone that gets too close to him. They get sent somewhere else, whatever it is. Standard approach for authoritarians also makes succession really hard because you've eliminated all your successors. That's the kind of thought process. So the things that are truly threatening to a state like China are actual freedom of the press. That scares the crap out of them. Because you know what their people would see if there was actual freedom of the press? That the system they're led under is not the best system. Winston Churchill very famously said, democracy is the worst of the worst political system except for every other one. Yes, he's exactly right. So if they saw the values, the freedoms, and the opportunities that came, that's why they find it so threatening. That's why China says, it's not our policy to get involved in the affairs of other countries, in the internal affairs. Of course not, because that's the last thing they want, is anyone to tell them that, you probably shouldn't disenfranchise and kill Tibetans. No, don't worry about that. It's not for you to look at, right? As long as we keep sort of manufacturing things for you, you'll leave us alone about that. Those are the threats they see. It's the ideas, and what it means for them is that you're threatening, those ideas threaten their very basis of control. And that's when you get them antsy and they try to create spheres away from themselves.
Okay, but do we have a final question? Yes.
Thank you again for a very informative talk. Unlike the old Soviet Union or even Russia today, China seems to have enormous capability to back up their military with their economy, logistically. What does a sound military strategy for the U.S. look like in terms of facing China, especially trying to balance our economic interests with China?
So the thing to recognize about trade and the economy is if we're concerned about us being overly reliant on them, they are very reliant on it goes both ways. I think I'm pulling these out from a paper a colleague wrote, and if I have the numbers exactly correct, roughly 30% of trade goes through, U.S. trade goes to East Asia, and then about a quarter of that 30% is Chinese. So for us, it's actually not that big. We're a bigger market for them than vice versa, at least according to my colleague. You can take it up with him if I misquoted something. That's what he told me anyway. But sort of taking that back, it's the same kind of principle, I would say. You cannot allow them to advance their sphere of influence. So this whole militarizing of the South China Sea where they're just pouring concrete on every little island and sticking missiles and guns, and we can't allow that to happen. I mean, we have a policy under the Obama administration of not taking sides. Why? One of them is objectively wrong, the other one's right. Let's take a side. Let's say, yeah, we recognize that's part of Japan. And you know what? We have a mutual defense agreement with them, so an attack on there would be an attack on the United States. Your move. There are things we could do like that. We could sell more equipment to places like the Philippines to help them better manage, give them a zero loan, nothing down, not expecting repayment kind of deal. But in general, more confronting, not accommodation. Accommodation just doesn't work with authoritarian challengers. It's a way you think you're buying time when in effect you're allowing their strength to grow while yours declines. So that's what I'd say to you.
Jonathan, thank you so much. As someone who has a degree in international relations, I feel like I've had a refresher course today, and it's just been wonderful. In appreciation for your being here and your great presentation, we want to present to you a limited edition of a bronze eagle that has been done by a local artist who's nationally recognized, Stanley Proctor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again so much. And again, let's show our appreciation. And we are adjourned.
You've been listening to a delayed broadcast of the Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting of January 13, 2017. This program featured a talk by international security expert Jonathan Altman and was recorded at the Florida State University Alumni Center in Tallahassee. Please join us again next time for another Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting on WFSU-FM.